In this hour, we'll be talking about Social Security. President Bush and others in the administration have said they believe that Social Security is in crisis and says that if the problems of the system are not addressed, it will be flat broke by the time that today's young workers are ready to retire. And he has said that he intends to make Social Security a top issue that he will deal with in his second term. Other people have said that, in fact, there is no crisis. They say that the system will be able to fully pay benefits through the year 2042, and that after that point, only some small changes will be needed to make sure that it will continue to be able to pay benefits. We expect that probably over the next weeks and months, we'll be doing a number of programs talking about this issue. This is really the first one of this year, and we have as our guest here in studio, Jeffrey Brown. He is Assistant Professor of Finance at the University of Illinois. And Social Security, pension issues, things that he's particularly interested in, has been here before on the program to discuss, and we're pleased to have him back. Questions, comments are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. If people have questions, comments, the only thing that we ask of callers is that they try to be brief in making their points so that we can keep the program moving and to get in as many different questions as possible. By the way, I do want to mention that our guest has been nominated for a seat on the Social Security Advisory Board. This is an independent, bipartisan board created by Congress, appointed by the President and the Congress to advise all of them, and in addition, the Commissioner of Social Security on matters related to Social Security. No doubt he will be confirmed and will be one of those who will be offering their advice in the months to come as this conversation goes forward. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Just to address the most basic point, and this is the one where right off the bat you're going to get an argument, or at least you're going to get a discussion, and that has to do with the status of the Social Security system and the ability in the future to pay benefits. And we have people using some fairly dramatic metaphors to describe the condition of the system. Things like it's like the Titanic headed for the iceberg. It's a train wreck in the making, and certainly other people have used the word crisis. And as I said in introduction, then others have said, no, it's not a crisis. There are some problems. We can fix them. But it would be a mistake to say that it's a crisis. Your view?
As is often the case when people are using colorful metaphors to describe a problem, the truth lies somewhere in between. I would not go so far as to say that Social Security is in crisis, because that somehow implies that today's seniors have to worry about their benefit checks, and that's simply not true. Social Security does face very severe long-term fiscal problems. I'm happy to go into detail about those. The problems begin in about 13 years from now when the system begins running deficits. Today, let's step back and say Social Security is structured as a system where the taxes that are paid by today's worker, for the most part, immediately go out the door to pay benefits to today's retirees. This type of system can work really well when you have lots of workers, very few retirees. But what's happening as a result of people living longer, people having fewer children, retiring earlier, and so forth, is that the ratio of people paying into the system relative to those receiving benefits has been steadily declining. If we go back, say, to 1960, there were 5 workers paying in for every retiree. Today, that's down to about 3.3. And within about 30 to 40 years from now, that ratio is going to fall to 2. And so what this means is that we're going to have increasing budgetary pressure as a result of Social Security, and those problems are going to continually grow. So I think, as long as we're talking about colorful analogies, I think a better analogy would be to say that this is like having termites in the foundation of your house, that your floor is not going to cave in tomorrow, but you would be foolish to ignore the problem. You'd want to address that problem. You want to not just simply replace the wood, but actually try to get rid of the termites and do something to place the system on a permanently sustainable course.
Well, let me raise this question about deficits and when they appear, because, again, this is one of those things that there seem to be disagreement about. That number that I mentioned, 2042 comes from the chief actuary of Social Security, who has been quoted as saying, look, we believe that the system, well, first of all, he says he acknowledges the fact that making projections into the future is difficult. So nobody really knows what's going to happen. But I think he would say something like, here's what we feel right now, that we will be able to pay full benefits until that year 2042. And that even after that, we could still pay 70% of the benefits. Now, there are other people who say, no, we really think that we're going to start to, the system is going to start to find it difficult to pay benefits much sooner than 2042. I mean, why is there this disagreement between the people who are actually crunching the numbers for Social Security and other people, other economists, other people who look at it and say, no, we think the problem's going to happen sooner?
Believe it or not, there's actually not much disagreement over the facts. There's disagreement over whether people are looking at the problem from the narrow perspective of the Social Security system or whether they're looking at the fiscal pressure on the entire U.S. government. And let me try to explain. When Steve Goss, who's the chief actuary, talks about going to the year 2042, what he is saying is that the Social Security program has a legal entitlement to dollars that are sufficient to pay full benefits through the year 2042. What this means is that for the last 20 years, Social Security has been running surpluses, meaning that the tax revenue that has been coming in has been greater than the benefit payments that have been going out. And that money has, at least on paper, been building up in the Social Security trust funds. The way that works is that the extra money Social Security turns over to the U.S. Treasury, the U.S. Treasury takes that money. And ideally, they would save it, but unfortunately, they've been spending it. They then issue bonds to the Social Security Administration that simply says that, okay, Social Security, when you come back to us and ask to redeem these bonds, we will give you that money. So Social Security has the legal right and ability to continue to pay full benefits through the year 2042. The problem is that because we haven't actually been saving those extra surpluses, but we have been using that money to underwrite spending in other parts of the government. This is not a partisan statement. This is both Democratic and Republican administrations, both Democratic and Republican Congresses have done this. It means that in the year 2018, when the system begins to run cash deficits and has to go back to Treasury and start, quote unquote, living off of the interest on those bonds, or actually a few years later start redeeming those bonds, Treasury has to provide them that money, but the question is, where does Treasury get that money? And the fact of the matter is they only have three options. They can reduce government spending, they can raise taxes, or they can borrow. And so when you think about it from a broader economic, a broader budget perspective, the pressure begins much earlier, even though Social Security could continue to pay out benefits for longer. And so the debate is really over not over those facts. I think as I explained it, the chief actuary would agree with exactly what I just said. I know him fairly well. The issue is, which of those dates do people think are more important? I tend to look at things from a standpoint of what our economy can bear and what the overall budget implications are, rather than sort of the arbitrary accounting that we have between various arms of government.
Mm-hmm. Well, one sort of further point, then I have a caller here I want to get to, and I want to make sure this person knows I will not make them wait forever. But when we look at some of the comments that people have made about the system crashing, essentially, that what we have here is a longstanding commitment by the government of the United States to pay the benefits, and that in a sense the system is backed by the full faith and credit of the government of the United States. And I don't think that anybody is expecting that the government will not meet the commitment. Perhaps, as you say, the question is, how do we meet the commitment? Because the money's got to come from someplace. Is anybody really thinking that at one point the president and the Congress could actually look at the American people and say, oh, well, sorry,
and not pay
the benefits?
I think a really important distinction to make is the president – members of Congress, both Democratic and Republican alike, everyone who has looked at this problem, the one thing that they can agree on is that no person who is currently retired or who is within, say, 5 or 10 years of retiring is going to see their Social Security benefit changed in any way. That's simply not going to happen. People who are already retired, already depending on Social Security, or those that are nearing retirement have absolutely nothing to worry about, either under the current system or under a reformed system, because no one's going to mess with that. The real debate is, what are we going to do about benefits for people who are younger today, people who are in their 30s and 20s and the children who've not yet entered the labor force? And there's a legitimate question of whether we as a nation can continue to promise that the benefits that they are paid in the future are going to continue to grow as is currently specified in the law. And just to put this in perspective, I have a daughter who's 30 years younger than me. Under the current system, if we have, otherwise identical jobs and so forth, she, because of wage growth in the economy, she will end up with a benefit that is about 30% greater than mine, even after adjusting for inflation. And one of the questions that's being asked here is, do we really want to continue to promise very high and growing levels of benefits in the future if we don't have a way to pay for them? Or should we figure out a way to scale back that growth so that my daughter gets the same benefits that I do, adjusted for inflation, but perhaps not more than that?
We have as our guest in this part of Focus 580, Jeffrey Brown. He's Assistant Professor of Finance here at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. We're talking about Social Security. We have several callers here ready to go. We'll start right in with line number one and the caller in Champaign. Hello.
Oh, hello. I'd like to find out, historically, when pensions and Social Security became a leftist issue. Historically, as far as I can find out, the pension system at the age of 65 came in, I believe, during the 1870s. And it was introduced into Prussia by Otto von Bismarck. Bismarck, I don't think, could be accused of being a leftist. And so this kind of a system has been around for a very long time and was introduced by, perhaps the greatest rightist leader that at least the 19th century knew, and I just like to have some comments on that. It seems so strange that the right seems to be so afraid of anything that smacks of I don't know, just decency and kindness to the aged. Obviously, at 65, most Germans at that point wouldn't have lived very long, as opposed to us. But regardless of those questions, it seems such an old system that has been so welded to most governments that I just don't understand why suddenly Bush puts it into the left column. That's all I have.
Well, all right. You want to tackle that?
Well, I'll only say that I would never refer to things as a leftist system. I'm not even sure exactly what that would mean. I think that the question here, at least my interest in this debate, and I think the interest of a lot of people, though, there are sort of extreme views on both sides of this debate, and unfortunately those extreme views are the ones that get a lot of the press. But my interest in this debate is a very simple one, which is what promises are we going to make to future generations, and how are we going to finance whatever promises that we do make? So there are really a couple of questions here. One is, what is the level of transfers that we want to continue to make from one generation to the next? We are currently poised through Social Security and Medicare, because of the way the system is structured, to basically heap a rather large, in the many trillions of dollars, financial burden on future workers. So I think one can ask a legitimate question of whether that type of a system is sustainable when we know that the aged population is growing relative to the population of the U.S. Just for what it's worth, I'm not sure that my personal views ought to be all that relevant here, but I am not, many people who support personal accounts are not in favor of eliminating sort of a basic Social Security benefit like we see today. What we're talking about is essentially taking the benefits that we provide to seniors today, continuing to provide those benefits and continuing to adjust those benefits for the rate of inflation. And the question is, do we want to let benefits grow more quickly than that? And if we do, how are we going to pay for it? And I think that is one part of the debate. The second part of the debate is, what form do we want those benefits to take? Do we want them to continue to be paid in sort of the current form that they are, sort of an inflation-indexed annuity from the government, or do we want part of it and only part of that to also be directed into personal accounts where people have some investment choice and so forth? So, you know, I'm as an academic, I'm less inclined to see this as a left versus right debate and more as an economic question of, you know, how are we going to pay for whatever promises we keep?
All right. Well, let's talk with another caller. This is someone listening this morning in Champaign and would be on our line number two. Hello.
Yes, thank you very much. I think that something that is getting short shrift in this debate and needs to be acknowledged and recognized is the Social Security system is more than just a retirement program. It's also a disability and death benefit program, and there are lots of people every year who need to, you know, avail themselves of that support. And, you know, when you get into trying to calculate how you're going to make this transition from, you know, a system the way it is now to one where people are, you know, helping out a lot of stockbrokers by, you know, investing in the stock market, the calculations just don't seem to you know, show that there's a way to do it without, you know, getting money from somewhere. And, I mean, I personally, I think that the money is in our economy, to have a good social safety net if we choose to do it. You know, it's a choice, and a lot of other countries do it. And we just happen to have a regime in force right now that believes in this ownership society where the people who own the wealth of society have the right to do anything they want and can, you know, set things up so that more wealth flows to them rather than taking care of the people who are, you know, the most needy in the society.
Well, comments?
The caller makes an excellent point at the beginning of his comments about the fact that Social Security is more than just a retirement program. Many of the benefits flow to survivors, i.e. widows, widowers, even children, as well as workers who become disabled prior to retirement. And one of the principles for reform that has been put forth by the president is that those components of the system will be retained. And I think there's bipartisan agreement that whatever is done to the system, that survivors and disability insurance components need to be protected in some way. Now, the details are tricky on this because if one is going to move to a system that is in part a continuation of a defined benefit and in part has some investment aspects, there are a lot of details that one needs to think through. Next week, a week from today, in fact, the National Academy of Social Insurance has a panel, an expert panel that I'm serving on, along with about 25 other individuals, very bipartisan. This panel is going to be releasing a report that analyzes these very types of issues and how could a system be structured so as to protect these other vulnerable groups, because I absolutely agree they should be protected. I just want to point out, in addition, that there is a common misperception that reforming the system in the way that the president is talking about is somehow going to hurt the poor or hurt the needy. And I think the facts suggest that that's not the case. At least it doesn't need to be the case. One can structure a program to where the poor can be made better off. In fact, the president's commission to strengthen Social Security from the year 2001 put forward a plan which many people think is going to be a model that the president follows. And the Government Accountability Office, formerly known as the General Accounting Office, which is sort of the research and investigative arm of Congress, it's a nonpartisan group, did an analysis of the extent of redistribution that would occur under this commission plan and compared it to the current system and actually found out that the plan could be more progressive because in addition to the accounts and price indexing, there were a number of elements that would actually increase benefits. It was going to establish a minimum benefit for the first time so that people who worked in the system over most of their career could be assured of not being in poverty in old age and so forth. So I think it's very important to know that the type of reform we're discussing is not incompatible with a world in which we take care of the least needy, or excuse me, the most needy among us.
Mm. I want to thank the caller. The lines are full, so I want to get on some other people. I do want to ask one real quick question here, because I know that you personally believe that the idea of the personal account, what the president has proposed for younger people coming into the system, that they should be able to take some percentage of that money that would go into the system and put it into some kind of self-directed, within limits, investment account.
That's correct.
And obviously there are other people who don't think that it's a good idea for a variety of reasons. And I also want to make sure people listening know that, you know, I'm sure in the weeks ahead we'll be talking with other guests on this same subject, and we'll have some people who have different points of view. Having said all that, I guess that there are also some people who say, well, if we're concerned in the future about the system having enough money in it to pay benefits, it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense to institute the personal accounts, because that means we're actually taking money out of the system. I mean, doesn't that even make the problem of paying the benefits worse if we allow people to take some percentage of the money that would go into the system and take it out?
No, it doesn't. In fact, if we think about this in terms of how economists tend to think about these things in terms of present values and so forth, people on both sides of this debate would essentially agree that most personal account proposals are, in a sense, neutral with respect to the financing, that there are really two debates going on here. There's a debate about the financing of the system, and then there's a somewhat separate debate about the form in which those benefits will be provided. The reason that directing some of that money to personal accounts doesn't harm the long-term financing of the system is that because when people who voluntarily choose to put part of their taxes into the accounts, they are doing so with an understanding that they will get a smaller defined benefit from the system in the future. And so, if you take a dollar and put it into the account today, that's roughly a dollar less of benefits that you'll get from the traditional system in the future. The idea being that the money in these accounts will then make up the difference. One of the important economic reasons why accounts might make sense, though, is that we have about a $10 trillion liability that we're essentially getting ready to pass on to future workers. The only real way that, short of reducing benefits, that we can reduce that burden on the future is for our country to save more today, for us to increase national savings. The difficulty is that Congress and the trust fund mechanism and so forth isn't a very good way of saving. Because there's nothing that stops Congresses and administrations from spending that money on other things. And one of the arguments is that if you put that money into the accounts, that money actually will be saved, that we can actually increase national saving in an economically meaningful way and therefore actually reduce the future burden.
We are here at our midpoint here. We have other calls we'll get right to. Our guest is Jeffrey Brown. He is Assistant Professor of Finance here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. We're talking about Social Security. The number, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let me also just mention real quick one other thing. The folks here on the campus at the Center for Advanced Study are organizing a forum to discuss Social Security reform. And they have scheduled this for next month, for Wednesday, February 23rd, 7 o'clock in the evening. It will take place in the Levis Faculty Center on the third floor. Right now, the participants that have been lined up include our guest, Jeff Brown, also Richard Kaplan, who's professor of law, and Mark Leff, professor of history, and there probably will be some others. And the folks at the center want to make sure that they understand that it's open to the public. Anybody who is interested in attending should feel welcome. So again, this is a Center for Advanced Study Forum on Social Security Reform, Wednesday, February 23rd, 7 in the evening at the Levis Center on the campus. Let us go on here to another caller, and the next will be line 3, Champaign County.
Hi, I was going to ask a sort of a technical question with a broader, broader philosophical approach. But since you're talking espousing this system so much, why don't we actually look at where it's been implemented, like in Chile and in Britain? If you look at what Paul Krugman's been writing, there's no reasons for either of those examples to be put forward as good examples to follow at all. The overhead in Chile is awful. The erosion of benefits in Britain has been lousy. So it's you know, projections that you suggested that it would be good for the poor are counterindicated by some very stark realities, it seems to me. But you keep talking about how it's inflation adjusted now, but one of the solutions that Greenspan, if I recall, has been espousing is that it isn't inflation adjusted, that it's not a cost of living adjustment. It's a reflects the growth of payroll. And I see that as a way of keeping elderly and other people that are on Social Security up with the productivity gains that our economic system is making. And that's my specific thing. I think it is indeed true that it is not a simple consumer price index adjustment that's being done, which would, I guess one would call an inflation adjustment. So maybe you would answer that first.
Sure. Actually, let me speak to both points briefly. There are over two dozen countries in the world, regarding your point on international experience, that have reformed their systems in various ways to include personal accounts. And I think it's fair to say that there are examples out there of where they've been done well, and there are examples of where they have not done well. Paul Krugman, who is was a brilliant international economist, but has since become essentially a political talking head for the New York Times, likes to essentially pick out a few examples here and there and provide what are not balanced views of the analysis of those systems. And I would encourage someone who wants to really understand what's going on in these various countries, there are a number of excellent academic articles out there that really go through and analyze the Chilean system, the Swedish system, the UK system, and so forth. And there are both good things and bad things about these systems. And I think the important lesson is that we should try to learn from them, not pick and choose those experiences to back up a particular political point. With regard to price versus wage indexing, the current system, the way it basically works is that from one generation to the next, or from one cohort to the next, average benefits rise with average wages in the economy, and that is typically faster than prices grow. One of the ideas that is out there is to change that away from wage indexing to price indexing, which is a way of slowing down the growth in benefits. That is, in fact, one of the things that the President's Commission forwarded a few years ago as a possibility. Now, the caller is right that one of the implications of that is while the individual's purchasing power would be constant, that's what the inflation adjustment does, it does mean that their sort of economic status relative to average wages in the population will fall. In other words, replacement rates is what people typically refer to it as, what fraction of your pre-retirement earnings are being replaced. Those will fall over time. But again, it's just a question of if you want to keep replacement rates fixed and you don't want to slow the growth in benefits, then let me just tell you briefly what that will require. Today, it takes about 10.5% of payroll to cover the benefit payments. By the time my youngest child, who is about 1 year old, by the time he reaches his normal retirement age, payroll taxes would have to be 19% of wages to continue to pay the benefits that are currently promised. And they're going to continue to rise beyond that. The rise in Medicare is even greater. So if you want to continue to promise the kind of benefits that we are through both Medicare and Social Security, you need to be prepared for the fact that payroll taxes may consume a third of income, and that's before we've raised a penny of revenue to pay for other government programs. Bill Clinton, it was in a different context, but he had a great quote that said that promising too much can be as cruel as caring too little. And I think that's something that those are wise words that we should be careful not to overpromise what we might not be able to deliver in the future.
Well, let me have a shot at this because quoting Clinton doesn't do a thing for me. I think he was Reagan light, basically, and he was a very illiberal president in a lot of ways, and so it doesn't persuade me at all. And I think other Democrats and people who are independents should look at this more closely. The way you frame the thing is that's the only resource, the only revenue enhancement is the payroll tax. What I was trying to get at the broader point about why shouldn't people who have lived in this society, have worked in this society, gain in the productivity gains, a benefit from the productivity gains that the society has developed? If I think it's totally going the opposite direction. My sense is that you know, you can make all these scary analogies that are ratios that, you know, there will only be two workers. Well, what do those workers, how much productivity do they have in this day as opposed to, you know, years ago when there were 12 or whatever it started out? Actually, I think that there was a certain point where there were actually less than there are now wage earners. I forget why that demographic shift happened. I think it was because of the baby boom on the other end. But the broader point is that, you know, and I'll say it right out, I think that corporations and should pay more taxes. They should, the employer side should get more involved in supporting this, because they are the ones that are gaining. They and their stockholders are simply the ones that are gaining from the productivity change gains of the industrial and economic system, and that's not fair.
Let me just say one last thing is, the productivity improvements that are projected on into the future are already incorporated into the analysis of the future fiscal impact of Social Security's growth. And if what you're saying is that you would like future retirees to continue to get wage index benefits, that's a perfectly plausible policy position as long as you're willing to say where you'd get the revenue from. And you're doing that. You're saying where you'd get those taxes, and then we can have a productive debate over that. Unfortunately, what's happening in Washington is a lot of people are saying they want to continue with the existing benefit formula, but they're not saying where they will get that money. They're kind of kicking that can on down the road, leaving it for future generations to figure out, and I think that's an unfortunate way to go.
We have other callers. Again, I hope the caller will forgive me because the lines are full and I want to get some other folks. But let me just, again, pick up real quick on the last point, because we have been talking about, the administration has, other people have been talking about this problem of Social Security for a while, and also the president has been talking about the partial privatization of the system for a while. And yet I think a lot of people have said, really, though, we've got to talk about something. You've got to do something else. Either you're going to have to raise taxes, you're going to have to decrease benefits, you're going to have to raise the age at which people can receive benefits. I mean, you're going to have to do something very concrete to make sure that we will be able to pay those benefits. Because, as you said, the money's got to come from somewhere.
That's absolutely right. And the only alternative to raising taxes or to cutting benefit growth is to do as Alan Greenspan said, which is to repeal the laws of mathematics. And we haven't quite figured out how to do that. So there is no getting around the fact, regardless of your views on personal accounts. You know, people have good reasons to be for them. People have good reasons to be against them. Regardless of that, there's a fundamental question here of how are we, you know, what level should benefits be? And if you want high level of benefits, you've got to specify where the money's going to come from to pay for them. If you are willing to let future retirees receive the same inflation-adjusted benefit as we have today, then that system is sustainable within the existing payroll tax. And that fundamentally is what a big part of this debate is about. And people, you know, intelligent, smart people can disagree.
Well, do you think it seems now that the Bush administration, at least according to some of the stuff that I've read recently, is there, they are thinking about, as we've discussed, and I know this is, it's not easy to understand, it's not easy for me to understand, is they're going to change the way that the benefits are calculated, essentially, which means that in future they would not rise as fast. This thing that we call the cost of living adjustment, whatever it is you call that, will be calculated in a way so that it won't rise as fast. And some people would, in fact, say that this constitutes cutting of benefits. Now, I think that's not exactly true, but that in effect that may be what happens at the end of the day. I mean, do you think that's what's going to happen?
Well, let me clarify one thing first, which is typically when we talk about a cost of living adjustment, we're talking about cost of living is what inflation is meant to capture. Mm-hmm. So if we move to a system which is indexing benefits, starting benefits to inflation, that is meant to keep up with the cost of living. What it's not keeping up with is the fact that over and above the cost of living, wages grow. I mean, today's generation is better off than the prior one and so forth, and that's what it would not keep up with. As far as what the president will propose, you know, that remains to be seen. I have a feeling that in the inaugural address and the State of the Union and a number of events in the coming month, I think we're going to see information sort of come out in pieces. I would be surprised if the president does not come out with a plan that looks that at least goes the route of trying to rein in the spending of the program. It may be through price indexing. It may be through something else. But that's the type of approach that I anticipate he will follow. And I should note that whether you like the guy or not and whether you agree with his priorities or not, I mean, this is actually compared to prior decades of the politics of this issue. This is a fairly courageous step to take to come forward to the American people and say we've got to make some changes to the system, because for too long the reason that the problem has been allowed to grow as much as it has is that, you know, messing around with benefit formulas and changing tax rates are not politically popular things to do.
All right. Well, we have a number of people who've been waiting patiently. Let's go next to Savoy, line one. Hello.
Hello. Thank you. Two things, really. One is I wanted to be sure I understood the money that goes into Social Security fund now for workers and companies, how much of that as a percentage goes to recipients?
It's a good question. Today, so in the year 2004, there were $565 billion worth of revenue flowing into Social Security, and they spent $500 billion of that on benefits, leaving 65 left. So trying to do math on the spot, but roughly 90% of that is immediately going out the door to pay benefits.
Okay, well, that's higher than I thought. Secondly, just an observation. I find it ironic that, you know, as we were taught in school, that Social Security you know, started under the New Deal because the stock market crashed and it was there as a safety net. It seems ironic that to switch it around where, you know, it's kind of at least partially relying on the stock market to take care of workers. And just lastly, you know, it's talked about a voluntary contribution. I would really seriously wonder if if that stayed voluntary. So I'll hang up. Thank you.
All right. Any
Only to say that at least the types of proposals that I am actually willing to support, they would not eliminate that baseline level of security that does not rely on performance of any particular investment. The idea here is to have what we call a mixed system that has a baseline level of benefits that continue to be paid out in the way that Social Security is, and then on top of that to have some opportunity for people who want to invest in bond markets or stock markets or what have you within sort of a somewhat controlled environment. So they'd be investing in diversified funds and so forth. I don't think that's actually necessarily inconsistent with the original view of Social Security, as long as one is maintaining that basic level of income security. I mean, some of Franklin Roosevelt's writings and speeches on this subject sort of envisioned a future in which people would also have the opportunity to contribute to what he called contributory annuities, which at the time was sort of a way of saying investing in additional types of investments on top of this basic safeguard. So, I just don't see these things as being inconsistent as long as we're not eliminating the current system, which is certainly not what I'm proposing.
All right. To another caller here, Charleston, line four. Hello.
Yes. My experience with Social Security, I applied for it in 96, and I'd already retired from the university here, had a small pension. I arrived at Social Security office in Champaign, and immediately they said, "Do you have another pension?" And I said, "Yes, from the university." I was qualified for $950 through Social Security. I had all my quarters in, and they calmly told me that half my benefits were taken away immediately because of what they called a windfall, which blasted me right out of the room. And it went into effect. I got my Social Security at half the rate. Now I have a raise from Social Security. They present me with a raise on Social Security from one hand and take it back with the other and put it on Medicare, which I had to go on when I was 65. So, and I had worked all my young life throughout my adulthood at lower and middle class working wages, so I couldn't pay in a whole lot. I paid in what my wages reflected, but I was not at the top of the heap, certainly. Well, a windfall at the top of the pile would be less destructive than at the bottom. So my experience has been one, I'm grateful for what I get, but a life of work then turned into $450 in benefits. It just seemed so unfair, and I felt like I had been robbed. So I'll hang up and take your answer off the air. Thank you, sir.
Well, I thank you for the call. At what point did it was not always because at what point did the law go into effect that said that we're going to reduce your Social Security benefit calculated based upon whether you receive some other pension?
Well, I don't know the full history in terms of the dates, but let me explain. It may be an unfortunate name, but what the caller was referring to is something called the windfall elimination provision. And the logic of it is as follows. The existing Social Security benefit formula is meant to be redistributive or progressive, which means that for every dollar you pay into the system, you get a higher proportion of that back if you're a low-income worker than if you're a high-income worker. So if you want to think about how much of your wages or your earnings to Social Security replace, that percentage is much higher for people at the low end of the income distribution than at the high end. One of the difficulties with people like myself that are state employees and therefore participate in a state program, the state of Illinois has opted out of Social Security. Therefore, we are not paying into Social Security. However, many of us, like the caller, like myself, have through other employment become part of the Social Security system. Their difficulty is if they look at us and they only count the years in which we actually paid into the system, we look like lifetime low-income people to them, even though we're not. And so essentially what they do is they apply a different benefit formula for us in order to avoid us being paid a high level of benefits because it looks like we're lifetime low earners, even though we may not be. The system is designed to sort of get it right on average, but it never gets it right for any one individual. And some people are undoubtedly harmed by that provision. Some people actually may still come out ahead. But that's the logic behind it. My suspicion is that this will continue regardless of what we do about this debate, although one thing I'll point out, state of Illinois employees, including those at the university, might care about the fact that some of the people that there are members of Congress, more on the Democratic side than on the Republican, but some of both, that would like to start making states like the state of Illinois participating fully in the Social Security system. And folding them in as a way of, in the short run, getting some more revenue. I don't think in the long run that actually helps the system very much, but that is something people should watch out for.
We have about 10 minutes left in this hour of Focus 580. Our guest is Jeffrey Brown. He is Assistant Professor of Finance at the University of Illinois, and we're talking about Social Security. The first of, I'm sure, a number of programs we'll be doing on this subject in the weeks and perhaps months to come. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next, we have someone to talk with in Chicago, line 2. Hello.
Thank you. Some time ago, Peterson wrote a book, Running on Empty, and he was on various talk shows, and I read the book, and one aspect of the book pointed out a number of years ago at the World Trade Center, a bunch of bankers and insurance and other investment brokers were gathered together, and when he arrived on, the Secretary of Treasury, O'Neill, arrived on the scene, he said, I understand this meeting was called to discuss the privatization of Social Security, and he said, there's nothing there to privatize, meaning its solvency was obviously bankrupt at that point to some degree, depending on whose accounting you were using. And today we're in the situation where we see automation, computerization, robots, and other things displacing workers to further reduce the number of contributions a worker would be able to make into the system. And therefore, the owner or management and so forth, a gain in terms of the benefits, but the workers and those who want to contribute and participate are being further reduced. So between outsourcing of jobs and other things like that, I can see that there will be less input in terms of contribution to the Social Security system and so forth. But in terms of our declaration, talking about the pursuit of happiness, I don't know how happy anyone's going to be when we realize the handwriting is on the wall, and as Pogo said a long time ago, we've met the enemy, and the enemy is us. But that leads to a final comment. Today on National Public Radio, Jerome McDonald here in Chicago is going to be discussing the economy and environment in China. And I wonder if someone could ever present a program dealing with the economy and welfare status of different governments throughout the world to see is there any better or worse, and what ideas we might be able to assimilate from them and for future gain or welfare. I thought I'd offer those as viewpoints. Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, thank you. You can react to that however you like.
Well, let me just say that you know, the word privatization, there's even a debate about the appropriateness of this word. And I just want to point out that the reason I think privatization is a little bit of a mislabeling is that that somehow implies that we're going to undo the government system and it's just going to be a free-for-all. And that's certainly not the case. What people are talking about is simply a government-administered, government-run pension system for defined contribution pension system. I mean, much in the same way that the government currently runs a thrift savings plan for its own employees, it could run something similar for everyone. You know, it is the workers that benefit from this. You know, currently only about half the people in the country at any given point in time have access to pension plans at work. Only about half the people in this country currently have access to stocks and other ownership in the society. You know, people talk about you know, the corporations that are doing so well out of this. I think that's debatable, but to the extent that they are, the best way to quote unquote spread the wealth is to make sure that everyone has a stake on the capital ownership in this country, and this is a great way to do that. And I've not seen any other proposals that would be able to expand that type of ownership to all Americans and not just those fortunate enough to work with companies that have 401k plan.
Let me ask you just real quick the president for some time has now been – has laid out this idea that people, younger people coming into the system should be able to take some of the money that they're paying into Social Security and to put that into an individual account within some restricted number of choices. And I guess as I understand it, the idea would be, say, we'd pick a series of mutual funds, for example, and that people could choose where that would go. And the critics of the idea, part of their criticism, I think, is they say, well, this just represents a windfall for Wall Street, particularly for the people that are in the investment business and who would be in the business of administrating those accounts because they would get some money out of doing it. Just lately, though, I've heard some people say, well, you know, in fact, that people on Wall Street are not all that thrilled about this idea because it's what it would mean for them would mean having to administer an awful lot of very small accounts, which would mean that there really wouldn't be that much money in it for them, and it might end up being more of a nuisance than it would be a windfall. Do you think that that, in fact, is more like what it would really be like?
Well, look, it would certainly be possible. I don't think anyone would want to do this, but it would certainly be possible to construct a system where administrative expenses were high and Wall Street gained, but that's not the type of system that most people are talking about. I think the best model that people have in mind is this federal thrift savings plan, which is essentially – it's set up as follows. Government workers participate in the system. They're given a choice. It used to be five broad index funds. I think it's now gone up to seven or eight. So you have sort of a government bond fund, a corporate bond fund, a U.S. equity fund, an international fund, like a balance fund, that sort of thing. Those are the investment choices. The administrative costs of that system are quite low, and therefore most of the gains are going to the individual worker, not to you know, not the Wall Street firms. I mean, I know it's popular to sort of come out and you know, argue that Wall Street's going to get rich off of this, but I think it's telling that there is a lot of sort of ambiguity about what Wall Street thinks about this, and I've heard those same arguments on both sides, and I think it's telling that they have not really lined up to do a major push on this because they do have some disagreement about whether it really means much for them.
Try to get at least one more caller. Fairbury. This is next person in line, line four, toll-free line. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
My question was, at the end of the 90s, all those index funds didn't do very well, as they tended in my own retirement accounts. There is no protection against that for these people's money, especially as they get close to retirement. The other thing was, isn't it just another layer of bureaucracy that we're going to set up within the Social Security Administration, you know, to manage and to take care of all these funds?
And I can, unfortunately, here I'm going to have to give the guest about a minute to respond. I guess I particularly wonder about the issue that the caller raises about risk.
Sure. Now, this is important. I teach finance, and what we know is that there's a trade-off between risk and reward. And if you're willing to take on more risk, then in expectation, you can hope for higher returns, although there's no guarantee of that. But let me just say a couple of things. For people that aren't comfortable taking this risk, number one, looks like it's going to be a voluntary choice. So if you want to stay in the existing system, you can. Second is, even if you choose to take the personal account, the proposals that I've seen, no one's going to force you to hold stocks. If you'd rather put that money into safe bond accounts and so forth, you can. And third, I would point out it's a common misperception that the current system is itself somehow risk-free, and it's not. When we, you know, when we look ahead at the fact that, you know, we don't currently have enough money lined up to pay benefits over the long run. And again, current retirees have nothing to worry about. But if you're 30 years old today, I think it would be mistaken to believe that whatever benefit you think you have been promised from Social Security is a sure thing, because it can be changed by an act of Congress. So, risk is an important element of this. Again, there's a trade-off with the reward. And the idea is that people will have the ability to allocate their portfolio in the way that they're most comfortable.
All right. We're going to have to leave it there with a promise that I'm sure on another day we will discuss this with other guests. I want to say thanks to our guest, Jeffrey Brown. He's assistant professor of finance here at the University of Illinois. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.